Welcome to the We Are Chafee podcast, where we connect through conversations of community, humanness, and well-being in Chafee County, Colorado. I'm Adam Williams, and today I'm talking with Reed Dills. Reed and his wife Karen were some of the rafting pioneers in the Arkansas Valley. This takes us back to the mid-70s. They owned Four Corners Rafting, the second outfit to establish itself here. Within a handful of years, there would be several dozen rafting companies. Things moved quickly, and it was a Wild West industry for a bit. No rules, no training required, no permits, no insurance. Just put out a brochure, get some paying clients, and head downriver. Reed was part of shaping the rafting industry that exists in the Valley today. He and others worked to create necessary regulations, to negotiate water flows, and to sort out the laws and shared opportunities for boating, fishing, and other uses of the Arkansas River. He was involved in getting the Arkansas Headwaters Recreation Area created and Browns Canyon designated as a national monument. Not to mention, he co-founded the Colorado River Outfitters Association and the Arkansas River Outfitters Association, both of which have celebrated he and Karen with lifetime achievement honors. He also was a founding member of the Collegiate Peaks chapter of Trout Unlimited and, well, the list goes on, with his service on this board of directors and that one, and then some more. I think you get the idea. Reed has been heavily engaged in many facets of caring for the waterways we all appreciate these decades since his work here began. So this conversation, it's a bit of a history lesson from someone who is part of it. It's also an opportunity to learn a little about Reed's and Karen's story. The We Are Chafee podcast is supported by Chafee County Public Health. Go to wearechafeepod.com for all things related to this podcast. That includes all episode show notes and transcripts and photos and whatnot. We're also on Instagram at wearechafeepod. All right, now here we go with Reed Dills. You've been very involved in water issues and conservation here for nearly 50 years. And I absolutely want to talk about that. I want to learn from you about that as we go today. But before we get there, I would love to learn about who you were before you came to the Arkansas Valley those decades ago. Like, where did you grow up? How did you get kind of these shaping, influencing factors for this love of the water and outdoors and rafting and so on?
Well, I'm from Kettering, Ohio, which is a suburb of Dayton, Ohio. I was born in 1947 and basically grew up in a middle-class family in a middle-class suburb. My dad loved to fish and my uncle loved to fish. And that's kind of how I got into the outdoors. When I was, up until I graduated from high school, I had hay fever so bad that I could get out. I joined the Boy Scouts and I went on the first camping trip and I had such a bad reaction that I never went back again. Fortunately, that didn't last very long, and I had to actually go to the doctor and get allergy shots. By the time I graduated from high school, I was pretty normal, but I was into fishing. I think that the thing that I tell people about what turned me on to the outdoors more than anything was when I was in fourth grade, my dad and two uncles and all the boys, we got taken up to Canada. So you go north through Detroit, and there was the Mackinac Bridge was just built, you know, and so we went up there and we spent a week camping and fishing and just had a great time. And then the next year, the wives wanted to go, so we went one more time, but we didn't camp. We stayed in a little, like a cottage or whatever. So then when I graduated from high school, I was really into music. I was a trumpet player, and my favorite class was band. And at a big school, unlike here, in a big school like that, we had a concert band, we had a marching band, we had an orchestra. I was selected to be in a elite summer band for 2 years, and that was a great experience. But I had a talk with my band director. I said, "I'm thinking about majoring in music." And he said, "Not a good idea."
Oh, no. I was just going to ask if you went with that trumpet to Ohio State, where I know you went to college. So that wasn't part of your life at that point.
Well, it became, yeah, I started, the first year I went to the University of Cincinnati and then I transferred to Ohio State for my sophomore year. So I hadn't played much, but I decided I was going to try out for the marching band, which I did. And I made it, played in the Ohio State. So not many people can say they played before 80,000 people.
Yeah. How did that feel?
Oh, it was really cool. I mean, we used to brag. I mean, the band director would always brag. He says, we practiced longer than the football team. Of course, back then, you know, the football players weren't in the weight room year-round and that kind of stuff. And so we're just talking about the daily practices. So, you know, they'd be out there for an hour and a half. We were probably out there for an hour, 2 hours. I don't remember the exact amount of time, but we had to memorize all the music for each show, which wasn't easy.
Would it change from week to week?
Oh, yeah, yeah. It was a different program. Back then, they didn't go to every away game. So you played for every home game. So back then, there were 10 games. So five of them would have been home, and there would be a new program for that. And then I remember going to Minnesota. We drove to Minnesota that's the only one I remember. I'm sure. For an away game. I'm sure there were some other ones.
You didn't ever get to go to Michigan?
No. We could have some real great stories about the conflict between Ohio State and Michigan. Yeah. off the record, I'll sing you the Ohio State version of the the Michigan fight song. At the time, I was thinking, well, I might do this again, but that next summer, I had tonsillitis really bad, and they decided to take my tonsils out. I got 2 degrees from Ohio State. I got a degree in wildlife management, and then I decided to go back and get a teaching degree. And, you know, this is the Vietnam War era. So as long as you were in school, you weren't going to get drafted. And the rules kept changing. There wasn't anything you had to do. The lottery didn't even happen until I had already graduated once. But talking about, did I make the right decision? I think back, I ended up being a teacher anyway. And I could have been, you know, I was thinking more of, could I be a professional musician? Whether it would have been classical stuff or whatever. I would have never made it. I could have played with Blood, Sweat, and Tears or Chicago, ha-ha. And bands like that, you know. But anyway, I wasn't that good. And I thought about, well, maybe I ended up only teaching for 3 years. My wife, Karen, and I, we met at Ohio State. She had graduated from the University of Florida. She had a degree in phys ed, and she was in a master's program when we met. And so we didn't hit it off right away because I had a summer job that year. I'd already graduated, and I was going to do a research project up in Lake Erie. So I really wasn't interested in having a relationship with a woman. And then when I came back, I remembered because I was an RA, a resident advisor in college. And so I didn't have a job, but I knew the guy who was in charge of hiring people. So I called him up and I said, got any jobs? And he said, yeah. I got the dorm. We put them in one of the dorms. And then I said, I remembered that Karen had worked in one of the dorms, resident halls at Ohio, you know, the previous year. And I said, you don't have anybody there by the name of Karen, do you? He said, oh, she's here in the office. So I talked to her, and we had our first date. Our second date, I took her canoeing.
Did you go fishing, too?
We didn't go fishing on that, but I had the previous year, I had a job in one of the state parks. And I did nature talks and stuff like that. And one of the things I did was we had a special deal with, there was a canoe livery on one of the rivers. And so we do a weekly canoe trip.
Was that something that Karen was into at that point? Like when you brought up canoeing?
No, absolutely not.
She's like, you've lost your mind.
No,
why would I do that?
You know, she was very adventurous. You know, I always teach her. I said, did you ever go fishing before me? And she said, yeah, my mom took me fishing a couple times with the cane. She's from Miami, Florida, with a cane pole, and we might have caught a few fish. But that was about it. But, you know, she was very outdoorsy, and it ended up being a good test because she loved that. And so we basically, that next year where I worked on my second bachelor degree, which was to teach, and she was finishing up her master's degree. And then So after we graduated, we'd both gotten into downhill skiing, but Ohio doesn't have very much good downhill skiing. There was a PE course at Ohio State, and they had a rope tow on one of the golf courses. So you learn the basics. And there was a ski hill about an hour north of Columbus, and a bunch of guys, we'd go up there occasionally on that kind. So anyway, we found a job in upstate New York, in Rochester. So we moved to Rochester, and that was a good experience. She got a job in a different school district, and I worked in an inner city school for a couple of years, middle school. But
what did you teach?
I taught basic middle school science, just general science.
Were you into fishing at this point as well? Like, or did that kind of fade out a little bit once you got into college and those things? Or was that always a piece of your life?
It kind of faded out because I didn't have time. My dad had a stroke when I was in middle school, and so he couldn't get around. He couldn't work, and then my uncle, you know, I do some fishing with him, but that and the combination of going to college, I had to work in the summertime, and I lucked out and I got a job as an iron worker. Not the kind of iron workers that climb up on tall buildings. I'm the type of guy that was tying rebar to build highways, you know.
Okay.
But anyway, I made a lot of money, but it was a hard job, and I just didn't have any time.
That was to help the family since your dad wasn't
able
to work?
Well, yeah, what it did was, I was making, when I got out of high school, I got a job as a plumber's helper for $1 an hour. And my mom met a guy at our Presbyterian church, and he said, I think I can get a job for your son, because he was involved with the local iron workers union. And so basically he just got me a job, and so I'd have to go down to the hall and just sit around. And of course I didn't have any skills. And so I would get all the crappy jobs, which was fine. But, you know, I went from $1 an hour to $4.50 an hour.
That's a big jump.
That's a big jump. That's a lot of money back then. So I made enough money being an RA my last 2 years, and then an RA when I went back again. And the money I made in the summer, I had no debt when I got out of school.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
That's a story that I'm not sure anybody today can speak to.
And my wife had the same experience. I mean, she went to the University of Florida, and I know that financially, she came from a middle-class family. Her dad worked for the Miami Herald, and her mom had odd jobs and stuff like that. But she ended up, with her bachelor's, she was debt-free. And then when she got her master's, I think I had to pay off a loan of a couple hundred dollars. So yeah, times are definitely different. That's for sure. So then because in New York you had to get a master's degree in 3 years. So at the end of my second year, we said, well, are we going to stay here or are we going to go somewhere else? And so we looked around. We said, well, I had two offers. One was at a small college in Oregon, and then the other one was at the University of Northern Colorado in Greeley. Both of them would have been from a neat place to go. It would have been fine, but my wife got a job running the residence hall where we were staying. So basically, we had rent free, and
that's what brought you to Colorado.
Yeah,
this was early 70s.
Yeah, 71, and so then we decided to get married, and we went back in 70. We got married in 72, April of 72. And then by then, Karen's sister was out in Boulder. She was working. She was living in a cabin somewhere, being a hippie. And so we visited her when we came out to look around, and decided on Greeley mostly because we had a good job. And so anyway, we spent a year then, and we got this job in Mancos, Colorado, which is halfway between Durango and Cortez. And it's a beautiful area. It's really small, back then, really small population. I imagine the town, Mancos, was probably 1,000 people. And
that's where you really, this is where the story starts to go into rafting.
Exactly.
And really takes you into what now is more than 50 years total, if we count being down in the Southwest, of this, you know, water conservation interest, rafting interest.
Well, you know, it's really, we skipped over the first rafting trip. And when we were in New York, one of my buddies from high school, he had graduated from college, and he went to Johns Hopkins to become a doctor. And he just got a hold of us once and said, "Hey, I heard about this rafting on the Yaquahanie River in Pennsylvania. You want to go?" And I said, "What's that?" Because my only, you know, back in those days, if you ever saw anything about rafting, it was always about going down the Grand Canyon in one of these big motor-powered boats. And so this was kind of, the trips were guided, but not like they are here. It was probably at the most a class three stream. So we did that twice while we were in New York. And when I went to school in Greeley, when I was working on my master's degree, we were invited to do a trip on the North Platte. And so I did that, and then we decided to buy a boat.
Hooked you about it? Like, what was so exciting about it just from those minimal experiences so far? Because this changed your life.
Yeah, it's really, it's hard to say, because I think it was a lot of fun, but we didn't really get into the excitement part until we moved to Mancos. I think it was a combination of just, at that point, we hadn't actually become committed boaters or anything. But we didn't even know when we moved to Mancos that the Dolores River was there, and that's what really changed our lives.
You didn't look it up on the internet before you moved?
it's amazing. There wasn't anything like that.
You had to go see it for yourself.
You didn't even have a push-button phone back then.
yeah, the rotary dial.
So when we got the job, I got a job teaching science, high school, and I taught chemistry, and I think I taught an outdoor ed course, and I taught a typing class. And Karen was a PE teacher, but she was also a counselor. And so, you know, we had a lot of time exploring, just driving around and finding places in the mountains to fish, and we did that. We met some friends and figured out that you could go rafting on the Dolores, and so that first spring that we were there, we probably went out about every weekend, and that's what really got us hooked. So, you know, we were out there a lot, and it's a long story which we won't have time to go into. But the Dolores at the time, it was a free flowing river, but they were building a dam on it before we even moved down there. The dam didn't get completed until we left, but the next year, we were both unemployed because we were both fired from our teaching jobs. Fired may be a strong term, but basically what happened was very conservative community. Karen was counseling, and she was telling girls who were sexually active to go to Planned Parenthood. And the principal found out about it. And the principal said, "I'd rather my daughter get pregnant."
Wow.
So anyway, the handwriting was kind of on the wall. And then they basically offered me a job that I couldn't qualify for. They wanted me I had like 9 hours of math in college, and they wanted me to be a math teacher. So the handwriting was on the wall. But it ended up being a good deal, because that was the first year where the federal government was you could collect unemployment if you were a teacher and you were laid off. And so we spent the whole year unemployed with a monthly check from the federal government. And so we really got into boating even more. And we thought, when we moved there, we were thinking, what do we want to do in the outdoors as a job? And we thought about working in a camp situation. But we decided after rafting, why don't we start a raft company? That was the year that we were laid off. And so we spent a lot of time researching.
How did you do that? Because again, obviously, I've already pointed out, you know, jokingly, the internet was not around at that point. How did you go about research to start a business that was in a field that, you know, there probably weren't a lot of rafting companies?
No, there weren't. There were hardly any. But I admit, there was a guy by the name of Preston Ellsworth. He had a raft company in Durango, and he belonged to the Western River Guides Association. And so he told me about that, and I said, I bet I can learn a lot if I join that organization. I think I went to my first meeting before we actually started running trips that first year. You know, you're rubbing elbows with the elite outfitters of the West. And so learned a lot from that. There was a guy, guy by the name of Bill McGinnis, who wrote the definitive book on whitewater rafting. And I think he published that book probably 1978, right, something like that. So there was literature out there, people to talk to. And a lot of it was just, like, the first thing we did that summer we had our first raft trip is we took our own training trip on the Green River. So we went up and spent a week, Karen and I, on our own, you know, floating 5 days on the Green River. And one of the main reasons was when we were just having fun, we were paddling. And back then, paddle boats had not become popular, and everybody went in an oar boat. And, you know, I had experience rowing, but not very much, so we did that. And the river that we were running then, we were doing half days on the Dolores. And it was a day trip. It was about 25 miles. And so we ran over 100 people that year, but it was just the two of us. So one day I'd row the boat and she'd pick me up in the van. And then the next day she'd row the boat and I'd pick her up in the van. So that's, you know, more being self-taught and just learning by doing.
How did you have the confidence to, you know, take responsibility for people out there on the water, but also just to start a new business? To go in a totally different direction with your life, away from teaching and those things, to say, we know how to create a livelihood and opportunity here that's totally new.
You know, we didn't know any of that. I like to tell people that the thing I learned mostly going to college was how to learn. That was the best thing, because having a degree in wildlife management has been helpful, even though I only had one part-time job, and that was my passion anyway. But when you're teaching, you're still learning there too, because you got to figure out how to present things to kids and all that. Well, the other thing that was going on the year that we were laid off, we were still looking for teaching jobs. We were willing to go. We said we were willing to go to Nebraska or Kansas. I don't know if we would have, but we just fortunately. You know, like you were saying, back then it was a little harder to find a job, but the school, Greeley, had if you were a graduate or you worked there, they would keep a list of potential job openings, particularly for teachers. So she actually checked that out and found out there was an opening in Buena Vista. And so that's how we ended up in Buena Vista. We would have come here even if we'd never rafted before.
Okay. And that was 1976. So that's almost 50 years ago that you moved here. It was for that job. You're connecting some dots for me, some of the questions I would have had. And you brought then this rafting company as well, right?
Right. And so that was interesting, because one of the things that happened when we were still on the Dolores, I got hired from this guy, Press Ellsworth, to do a Sierra Club multi-day trip. And so I met one of the guides working for him on that trip, and we got to talking, and I said, well, you know, I'm moving to Buena Vista. Do you know anything about the Arkansas? And he said, yeah, I work on the Arkansas, but I'm quitting at the end of June. And so, you want my job? So I never even interviewed.
As a guide, or what was it?
Yeah, as a guide.
Okay.
So,
have some good luck with these things connecting.
Oh, it's amazing. Yeah. So I get the job. So I spent 2 months working on the lower river, and we still had, you know, we had started our raft company, but it was really good training. So I did my first private trip in Browns Canyon in August of 76. Never been down there before. Scary as hell. I mean, took some people with me that I had met on one of my trips. A couple of them became pretty good friends. One guy was a ski instructor in the off season. So pretty athletic people. So we went down and we'd heard about some of these, you know, we'd scout rapids, and we got the most famous rapid in Browns Canyon is Zoom Flume. And so we got out and walked down there, and oh my God.
Was it different than the Dolores?
It was only different. Most of the Browns is class 3, and most of the Dolores, the trips that we were running on the day trips were basically class 2. But we did some multi-day trips, and we did some longer trips, and on the longer trips there was some class 4 stuff. And I could tell you some interesting stories about running class 4 with not very much skill, but a lot. But anyway. So Yeah, that's how that happened. That we ended up here. We'd already started our raft business, and so we moved here in August. Karen had a full-time job. She ended up becoming, this will blow you away, she had the choice of being a high school PE teacher or a middle school teacher. She said, I want to be a middle school teacher. And if you know much about middle school kids, that's probably the toughest.
I've got one of each at this point.
Yeah, well. So anyway, but you know, she just felt she could be more, she could have more of a positive impact on the younger kids. And so anyway, she did that. And
did she keep teaching until retirement?
Yeah.
Here? Okay.
You know, when we retired in 2001, we sold the raft company, and she had enough. She had 25 years in teaching, so we were both 54 when we retired.
Did you also teach, or did you just have the rafting company? Because you had that for 25 years.
Yeah, and I initially started subbing. So for the first 2 years, I would, you know, there were never any teaching jobs open that I could apply for full time in the Valley, but I did sub. I subbed both in Buena Vista and Salida for 2 years, and I also Karen got named as the volleyball coach, first time they'd ever had volleyball, and yeah, she was a PE teacher, but you know, she'd never played volleyball. I'd never played volleyball, so so that's another self-taught. I mean, she went to clinics. I went to a few clinics. So she was the varsity coach. I was the JV coach. And we did that for 2 years, and then the school realized that we need another professional coach. And by then, I was getting pretty busy in the off season with the rafting business. So
you brought your business from the Southwest. You guided in place of that guy, it sounds like, initially, but then you did have your own business here. One of the early ones, wasn't it?
Right, we were the second.
So the one that you came and replaced that one person, that was the only company at that time until you established yours?
No. So the company that I was working for was called River Runners, and they're still here in the Valley. They were, at the time, they were down on the lower river, downstream of Cotopaxi.
Okay.
And they were owned by two college professors in Pueblo. So I spent my whole time down there. In the interim, I knew, you know, that there was a raft company in Buena Vista, part of the Trailhead. So back then, the Trailhead was owned by two people, Dick Scar, who just passed away this last year, and then Al McClellan. He was the guy, he was the raft guy. So they started 2 years before us. So we were 76, they started in 74, I think. And then River Runners, we had the option to buy River Runners, but we were too egotistical. We already got our own river, you know, Four Corners Rafting. We don't need to do that. We probably should have, but so River Runners got bought by a guy who was running Jeep tours in Poncha Springs. So then River Runners in 77 moved to Poncha Springs. So that was the only river in the lower in Chaffee County. That was the only outfitter down there. And then it was just the two of us up here, Rocky Mountain Expeditions and then Four Corners Rafting. And then 77 was one of the worst drought years on record. We had a couple of outlets who would book trips, and to give you an idea of how dry it was, Browns Canyon, we only had 1 week in Browns Canyon, and it was too low. And so, but we were able to go downstream, and I secured a couple contracts with church camps and dude ranches and stuff. So even though we didn't get a whole lot of walk-in business, we got quite a bit for our first year. We probably didn't lose any money. And I was able to hire two guys that I'd worked with down in Durango. And so they came up and spent time. The woman who worked at the school in Mancos, she came up for the summer and drove our van. And then so there were four of us that first year on the water. So we had a house on Baylor. We operated on a house out of Baylor. So
the neighborhood that's by the school.
Mm-hmm, that whole little
suburb. I would not have guessed that's been around enough years.
Those houses were pre-built, and they just about finished up most of the houses that had put in there in 76. But the interesting thing about that was when we moved here, there was only one paved street, and that was Main Street, and that had only been paved a year or two prior to us coming. And so all the rest of the streets in town were dirt, and the developer said, I'll pave the streets of my development once we've sold all the lots. So maybe 3 or 4 or 5 years later, the street got paved. And then by that time, and I don't know exactly what was going on, but you know, a lot of the other places in town were getting paved. Talk about a weird happening. We were unemployed for a year. Karen had a full-time job. I had no full-time job. We come here. We qualified for a house. No down payment.
Yeah, that's very, very different than where we are now, isn't
it? Oh, yeah. Well, the house was $28,000.
But we are talking, I guess, mid and going into the late 70s. Man, that's almost unthinkable. So you could drive by that exact house now. Like,
oh,
it's
yeah.
still standing. The neighborhood is there. And that same house would go for, you know, 20 times?
Probably 400,000.
That's incredible.
At least 350 if it's been well taken care of.
Yeah. I think it's well above that at this point.
Yeah, it could be.
Yeah. Let's go ahead and get to some of the water matters, because I've not talked with anybody on this podcast who I think has this wealth of knowledge that you do. So this is an educational opportunity for me, and certainly going to be for some other listeners who just really aren't aware of what the history with rafting, maybe in particular, but it's the conservation matters and the management of the river and all of these things that have made this tourism industry possible in the way that we know it now, but also extends to, I think, probably so much more. So where would you like to go with, you know, I know this is of interest to you too.
Well, this all ties in with the creation of the two outfitter organizations, because basically, so we're here in 76, we met Al McClellan, you know, and it wasn't cutthroat back then. You know, we became friends. We went to parties at his house. I mean, and we knew Dick a little bit, Dick Scar. But when we started in 70, well, when we did our first commercial trip on the Arkansas, which would have been 77, you didn't need to get a permit. You didn't need to get a license. You didn't need to get insurance. You didn't need to train anybody. You didn't need to do anything except put out a brochure or whatever and start getting people to come. Now that changed quickly. And so 77 was a terrible year. 78 was a great water year. 79 was a great water year. And so by 79, a lot of us in the industry realized there's a need for both a statewide organization and an Arkansas organization. And I'm thinking back on this, a lot of the, so I met, when I went to these Western River Guides meetings, I would meet other outfitters from other parts of Colorado. So we all been briefed on, you know, what's going on, how do you run a business and that kind of stuff. So we were seeing the handwriting on the wall. And a few things caused that to happen. I helped create both the Colorado River Outfitters Association and the Arkansas River Outfitters Association. And they were created in the same year. Colorado River Outfitters Association was created in October of 1979. AROA was created in November of 79. And so some of the reasons why we felt why we needed to create these organizations was something called the Emmert decision, which I'd like to talk about a little bit in detail. But the Emmert decision basically said a guy was in 76 was arrested for floating through private property. He was arrested by the sheriff, and instead of paying the fine, he decided to take it to court, and he lost. And so we were under the impression then that you can't float through private property in Colorado. And so that was one big issue that needed to be addressed. So that was important for both organizations.
Did you feel like that set a precedent then, that, or that was just your interpretation, or who was deciding that you couldn't float through private land?
Well, back then, there was confusion about the law. And because so this happened in 76. The trial was in 77. The interesting thing was the judge said at the end of the trial, there's enough case law here for you guys to do this correctly. And so that's what happened. So the legislature, to nobody's knowledge, in 77 passed a law that basically said you cannot be prosecuted criminally for floating through private water. You could still be charged civilly if you basically got out of the river and went up on the bank or went up on a rock or whatever.
So charged for trespassing.
Right. And so we had that issue, which it takes a while to get resolved. And then we had, on the Arkansas, we had BLM issues. By 79, we were being managed by the BLM. And basically, we needed to get a permit from them. probably needed to have insurance. And the problem was they weren't doing anything. They were just taking our money and sending it off to Washington. And so they didn't have any additional money to do any management. So that was a big thing on the Arkansas. And the other things were like, you know, on the Arkansas, you know, 40% of the river was private. And so we didn't have any put-ins and takeouts. Well, it ended up being the only put-ins and takeouts we had were go to somebody's house and make a deal with them to put in. And then Hecla Junction was the only, which is BLM, that was the only really public takeout on the upper river. And then we found out that it wasn't just here, it was the entire river. If you were going to run it, we needed to form this organization to basically start leasing property. And so that's one of the things in the early years was we leased a lot of property.
When we say 40% was privately owned, what I'm picturing, just to use round numbers, let's say it's a 10-mile stretch, 4 miles, which could be scattered in any number of ways in that math, are privately owned, which means you're frequently trying to go through somebody else's owned water.
Right. So if you want to jump ahead, we can do that because it is important, that this whole Emirate thing, because we got the thing resolved. It took a while. We ended up hiring an attorney who worked at Denver University, and this is like 83. And we basically, they did all the research, and they found this law that had been passed that nobody knew existed. They went back and read all of the hearing stuff about, so there, you could find out what the actual intent of the rule was. And they did all that, and basically, they ended up taking that to the Attorney General. And the Attorney General said, yeah, we have a law now that protects you guys. And it was created that the year after the lawsuit that the guy lost. And so what that basically said was that there's no criminal trespass for floating through property. The only issue that you have now is if you get out of the water on private land, you could be charged with a civil trespass. So that's the way it is today. So what that basically did, we didn't have to worry anymore about being able to float through private property. But we still have, today we still have that issue about getting out of the boat. And so and that's why you see, if you float down the river, you'll see flying, you'll see a sign that says, entering private property, you know, don't get out or take out or put in here.
I was going to ask if you could identify where those lines were as you go now.
Pretty much, yeah, unless the signs have been taken down. But yeah, it's pretty much, you know, there's maps out there, and most people have, they've got it all figured out. And the other side of the coin, too, is if you're in a dangerous situation, let's say you're on the lower river and it's in flood and you flip a boat, you know, but then obviously you swim to shore. Well, then you're not going to be prosecuted for doing that. You know, nobody's going to do anything about that.
Right. Okay. You were also part of creating the Arkansas Headwaters Recreation Area.
Right.
Right. You've been involved in many things. You mentioned Browns Canyon. Were you part of ultimately that being designated as a national monument, by the way, 10 years ago?
I was.
Okay. So, I mean, you've been very involved in all of this. You know, you can take that whichever direction you'd like to next, but just in terms of, I guess, yeah, establishing this history for those of us who have come in years far more recent than when you did, and there's, I don't know how many rafting outfitters now. It's a lot more than just a few. Back when you started, you know, from that place where you started, where there was just a few and you owned one of those outfitters, to where we are now, what else is it that you would like people to understand has been this process in progress?
The park was a long time in coming, and basically in the early days, one of the things we worked on once we got the Emirate decision solved was we wanted to make sure that, you know, sheriffs weren't out there arresting people or they weren't shutting the river down, which they technically couldn't do, things like that. But in 79, 78, there might have been 10 outfitters on the river. By 83, there were 59.
Wow.
59 outfitters. And so we had already pretty much realized that that was a problem, and there was no regulation. The other thing that was going on was that we had the flow issues, and then we had a problem with the BLM, because they wouldn't do anything. They finally put in Fisherman's Bridge, and they did a little grading of the road down to Heckler Junction, but that's the only thing. They basically came out and said, by federal law, we can only touch on what's going on our property, so we can't really manage you. How many businesses do you know that go to the state and say, we want to be regulated? And that's what we did, both the Outfitter Association. And we did that because a lot of things were happening, like you'd get an outfitter show up, he didn't have workman's comp, he didn't have insurance, he didn't have employees. So we saw the handwriting on the wall because, somebody in a commercial raft trip and somebody goes over and they die and nobody's had any training or anything. So we got state parks involved in 84. And so we got legislation passed to basically require to have an outfitter's license, to do minimum amount of training. You have to have insurance. You have to have employees. And so that was a big deal.
Why did you have to have employees as opposed to how you and your wife started, where it was just the two of you? Why couldn't you be that small of an outfitter?
You could be an outfitter. It's not precluding you being an outfitter. It's precluding you from saying that your employees are not employees, that they're independent contractors.
Oh, gotcha.
And so what happens there is there's no responsibility for them to get workman's comp or unemployment insurance or anything like that.
Okay, I understand.
So we're trying to protect our employees as much as anything. And we want to level the playing field so everybody's playing by the same rules.
They could have taken down the whole industry if this continued to be the Wild West with no sorts of rules or boundaries or expectations of how a business functions. It could have affected you all if there were dangers that were taken and people were hurt or died.
Oh, yeah.
And then suddenly there's, even if it's just bad PR, right? Nobody wants to come out here and raft the Arkansas because, something bad might happen. How would you know as a customer who's legitimate, who's not, who's skilled, who's not?
Yeah, you're just picking up a brochure.
Yeah.
So, that was getting in bed, so to speak, with the state, which was at that time was parks, because parks and, recreation, wildlife and parks were separate back then. We spent a lot of time on that. And, most of the work that was done was by both of our associations. I was one of the persons who did, particularly on the Arkansas, did most of the stuff. There's another guy who still lives here. His name's Pete Macris. He owned Buffalo Joe River Trips, and he's still around. He sold before we did. But so Pete and I, basically, when it came time to represent the outfitters to create the state park, we did that. So moving ahead quickly, so in December of 85, we convinced the BLM to start working cooperative with state parks. So in 86, we started taking raft trips for politicians and parks people. And then 86, the BLM said, they started talking about doing a cooperative agreement with state parks. And so that was the beginning of that actually happening. We ended up hiring Jerry Mallett, who you probably don't know. Jerry Mallett he was the head of the Western River Guides. He was the hired hand for Western River Guides at the time. Since then, Jerry moved to Salida, became a county commissioner for one term, and he's still here. But anyway, we hired Jerry because he had lots of connections, both statewide and federal, to work for us to help get that happen. So the Outfitters Association hired him, and then everything got approved in 88 for the state park. And so in 89, they created a 22-member advisory board to basically write the plan for the park. Every entity was represented, whitewater rafting, kayakers, landowners, water providers.
Did you find a lot of cooperation back then across, say, the different interests, the different politics, the different maybe, financial interests?
No, not as much as you see today, but bringing all these people together helped because you're looking at a live person. When you're sitting in a room with 22 people, you're not just going to, if some organization has a bad reputation about this or that, you're going to be talking to a real person. So what's the real person saying? The biggest issue we had when they wrote up the plan, they basically left the flow issue out of it because they knew it was going to be really contentious. But in writing the plan, that was the start of Roe versus Wade, ROW. So you've got the boaters against the fly fishermen and the waders. That, I mean, that became the cup buzzword no matter whose side you were on. You know, this is another place where these things happen that you don't really have control over. You know, like how did I end up here? Well, it's kind of bizarre, but I did. How did we get flows in the river? It's kind of bizarre. I started working on flow issues in 82. In 89, the reservoir had been enlarged. Twin Lakes and Reservoir had been enlarged probably in 76, 77, but they decided in 89, they needed to go back and they had to work. They wanted to build a campground and they had to work on the dam. So they were originally, the Bureau of Rec was going to originally, and in fact, we need to be clear here. The Bureau of Reclamation operates all the dams on the Arkansas. And so they were in charge of how the flows were being released. And our big issue was, you got all this water up here and you're releasing it in the wintertime. And we want water through August. We'd like to have it through the whole month of August, but we'd really like to have it through August 15th. And so we were working on that at the same time as we got the state park.
Why were they releasing it during winter?
Because evaporative loss, if we release the water during the summer and it's sitting in Pueblo Reservoir when it's not being used, there's more water that's actually being evaporated off. That was the main reason they were moving. So basically what happened in 89, we had this concept of flows being released for the benefit of recreational boating, both rafting and kayaking. We had that idea for a long time. It was just, how were we going to implement it? We learned that we couldn't afford to own water, but Colorado law allows water to be moved from point A to point B without owning it. And so that year, you know, they started out, they came out and said, Bureau of Rec said, well, we're going to release water, but not when you want it. And so we said, why not? We pulled together some meetings, and it wasn't just the outfitters. We got the fishermen involved and some of the landowners and stuff. And we basically talked them, that was kind of a drought year, and we talked them into actually releasing the water in July and August. And we said, well, we want 1,000 CFS. And of course, the waiting people didn't like that. But this is kind of the weird thing. In the early days, when we were fighting over flows, Trout Unlimited was okay to a point, and I mean, they didn't fight it very hard. 89, we had this test run, and it worked. Now we have state parks, because 90 is when state parks came and started running things. So now we have state parks, and we've got the ability to do it. So we started working out an actual flow release for 1990. And it was like, it was a test. We put together a plan. We gave it to the Department of Natural Resources, which basically said, you know, you'd have these late flows. So that would have allowed flows through middle August. And so we did that. Everything was fine. Then the Roe versus Wade got ugly the next year because Trout Unlimited went from, we don't like it, but we can live with it, to we don't like it, and we can't live with it. And so we got another year approved for basically the same flows, but they ended up suing. And there was a restraining order placed. Fortunately, the season was almost over, but there was a restraining order placed on releasing that water. So at the end of that season, we really knew we needed to get more cooperation. And one of the things that they did was BLM says, well, we're going to do a six-year study on water flows, and we're going to have Department of Natural Resources be in charge of that study, basically the wildlife portion. And so they did that, and in the interim, we were able to keep those flows the same. And we actually went back in court after that, and they threw the case out. They said that, you know, you don't have any standing in this. So basically, TU couldn't sue anymore, and they had to work with everybody on getting flows. But where the Roe versus Wade comes in, this is the interesting part. We all thought in the early, like at the end of the 80s, they were pissed off about more flows because they thought it might be harming the fish. And that wasn't their argument at all. Their argument was they didn't like rafts. They didn't like people floating by them in rafts and kayaks. Now, over the years, that changed from just being the fact they didn't like people, other people being on the water, to more of an environmental issue. But so that's how that Roe versus Wade got in there. Over the years, by the time that I retired, pretty much had a yearly deal. So we've had this voluntary flow program. It's even better than it's ever been now. There's a lot of cooperation. There's nobody's, you know, Trout and Lemon's getting along with the outfitters, and there's really no conflicts anymore. The other problem, which we talked about a little bit earlier, was why did they originally move the water during the winter? And we talked about evaporation. Well, the other part of the deal was the state has agreed to compensate the owners of the water conservancy districts by paying for the evaporative loss or providing for the evaporative loss. So let's say you have 1,000 CFS of evaporative loss in the reservoir that wouldn't have happened if they'd have kept the water upstream. The state will provide the actual water that has been lost. So there's no net loss. So that way you've got the water providers happy because they're not being dinged by this program.
It took some time to develop these processes, it sounds like, decades ago. Do you feel like there are any challenges now?
The problems that we're going to have now are basically climate change issues and remembering that the water that we're using is West Slope water. It's coming from the West Slope. You know, there's this big push now because of climate change to... There could be instances where the water, it's not available for the Arizona and California, and so they're going to make a call on the river, which is going to mean that some of the water that normally comes over won't come over. It's not just the Arkansas. It's almost every Front Range city in Colorado is using the West Slope water is basically what they're using. And so that's probably the main concern that we have now is, will, in the next 20 years, will there be sufficient water to maintain the flows at the rates that we've become accustomed to?
Do you feel like with these different organizations you've been part of, you've helped establish things like the state park, the national monument, there's a lot of conservation effort that you have been involved in for basically 50 years. Do you think about this in terms of legacy and what it means that you have been involved in that's going to live on well past all of us as we go in the future?
Well, yeah, I've thought about that a lot, and I've thought about even writing a book, but I don't know if that's ever going to happen. Maybe the best that could happen is I could write historical articles for the newspaper because I have so much information. I mean, it'd be nice to get more recognition in some way, but the important thing is what we've done is really good thing. And it points to how, when I was on the Colorado Water Conservation Board for a term, and talk about people with different demands for water, the thing that blew me away about that was when we were in that room, we were all for the greater good of the state of Colorado. You know, we might have had a guy from North Park who just, you know, all he cared about was irrigation and he could care less about anything else. And you might have somebody from Denver Water Board who's got other issues. But, you know, when we sat in that room and hashed out things, I mean, I can't remember a time where there was a shouting match or anything. We just did the best we could do. And I think that's continued. And I think a lot of people don't realize that some of these boards that people are on in the state are really valuable.
In retirement now, if we circle this back to your childhood, you started off with fishing. Fishing has been a part of things throughout the years. Is that a primary activity for you now, especially as it relates to getting out on the water?
Oh, yeah. We've gone from a whitewater boating to float fishing, mostly. And we've become real small stream aficionados. We, you know, for a lot of reasons, it's not that important to catch really big fish anymore. It's more important to be somewhere where, you know, it's not crowded and you're in a beautiful place.
Do you feel like you were part of bringing crowds here?
You know, it's interesting. The time period we're talking about, the river was heavily polluted. You know, an average age for a brown trout was 4 years. You know, a 12-inch fish was a big fish. There were a lot of people environmental people. I mean, the list is huge. The Bureau of Reclamation. You know, we had a terrible spill about '85, where and the river turned orange and killed all the fish in the river. We've pretty much solved the pollution problem on the Arkansas.
How did you continue rafting during that period? And I imagine that pollution lasted for many years. How do you continue to have tourism on that? I would have thought that would have been unhealthy in various ways.
Well, you know, because all those structures were built in the early 90s. And surprisingly enough, there were not many people doing commercial float fishing trips, hardly any.
Was it only the fishing that was affected in that way? Like to be a human being rafting, yeah, to fall in,
yeah,
to
was,
swim,
there
no
was
issue?
Never a concern about water quality. You have to remember the heavy metals that were in there that were causing problems for fish. When that water got down to Pueblo Reservoir, half of it was used for municipal purposes. And so, you know, they had to have a way of making sure that what was in that water wasn't going to harm their public. So that part of it had been solved quite a while ago. So there was never an issue about the pollution that was in the Arkansas. It was not the kind that you would, if you went in, you fell in, you're going to get sick. Basically, because the stuff that was really going to hurt you is if you started drinking the water out of the river on a daily basis. So the pollution issue, as bad as it was, I mean, now we've got a gold medal trout stream, and which is another plus, and a lot of different people were involved in that. I mean, just because it takes a lot of entities to clean up a river.
Thank you for sharing all this history, Reed.
You're welcome.
And for sharing something of your story. This is really interesting. I know we could have gone down, well, to use a pun, many streams, and you know, really talked about a lot more, but I appreciate what you've shared.
If you need any more info, just give me a call.
Thank you for listening to the We Are Chafee podcast. You can learn more about this episode and others in the show notes at wearechafeepod.com and on Instagram at wearechafeepod. I invite you to rate and review the podcast on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. I also welcome your telling others about the We Are Chafee podcast. Help us to keep growing community and connection through conversation. The We Are Chafee podcast is supported by Chafee County Public Health. Thank you to Andrea Carlstrom, Director of Chafee County Public Health and Environment, and to Lisa Martin, Community Advocacy Coordinator for the larger We Are Chafee Storytelling Initiative. Once again, I'm Adam Williams, host, producer, and photographer for the We Are Chafee podcast. Till the next episode, as we say at We Are Chafee, share stories, make change.